It's Monday evening. It's just after 10 p.m. It's Chin 97.9 FM. It can only be the Gaelic Hour. Welcome indeed, Fáilteoireacht in Tarascheach, and I hope you are ready for an hour of wonderful, wonderful, wonderful entertainment. Tonight on the programme we are going to meet the director and cast of the Tara Players, and we're also going to talk to Anne Renault. And Anne Renault is about to launch her book, a children's history book on Gros Eel. But before we get to that, as I said, this is Austin Camerton. You're welcome to the Gaelic Hour here on 97.9 FM. We're also out there on Rogers, and we're on the internet at thegaelichour.ca or chinradio.com. And this programme will be available as an archive, as are all my previous magazine programmes on my website. In addition, the music that we play on air is available on a playlist tab on the website. And we also have a calendar, and the calendar lists events that are going on. But one of the things I like to do as well on the Monday evening is bring you up to date on some GAA results. And this weekend, Galway and Mayo. And I feel like playing the Saw Doctors. Well, Galway beat Mayo. Galway 2-10, Mayo 9 points. And Galway gained revenge on Mayo for their National Football League semi-final defeat to kickstart their Connacht Senior Football Championship title bid. And that took place in Salt Hill. Some of the other scores: Waterford a goal and 6 points, Clare 7 points, Tyrone 13 points, Fermanagh 1 goal and 9 points, Meath 2 goals, 11 points, Kildare 1 goal and 8 points, Down 15 points, Cavan 11 points, Louth 1 goal and 11 points, Wicklow 14 points, Cork 2 goals, 14 points, Limerick 7 points. To keep you up to date with some of the events that are going on in the city, don't forget the Irish Society sponsored drop-in is going on tomorrow between 11 and 2 p.m. and that's at St. Margaret Mary's at Sunnyside in Fairburn. And there are still some Irish set and ceilidh dance classes going on at Villa Marconi, and that's 1026 Baseline Road. And this week down at the Heart and Crown, and my continued gratitude to the Irish Village and the Heart and Crown for their sponsorship of this programme, Evans and Doherty will be visiting town. And that is on Thursday, Friday and Saturday. And down in Mother McGinty stage, Barry Williams is there on Thursday, Friday. And don't forget, on Wednesday night on the Heart and Crown stage, it's Cherry Suede. And Tara Players opens on Thursday night, and that is the 24th, with Love in the Title. And of course, we will be hearing from Cara McKay and the cast of Love in the Title in tonight's programme. Cara McKay, welcome to the Gaelic Hour. We're sitting here in the Arts Court as you're preparing for opening night of Hugh Leonard's, what is it?
Love in the Title.
Love in the Title. And certainly, yeah, the little I got to listen on there, it's love is in the air in a variety of interesting ways.
Exactly.
What's going on in there?
Well, in this play, Katie, who is in modern day, has conjured up her mother and her grandmother, but she hasn't got to choose what age they are. So they've come up in, Grandma has turned up at the age of 20, long before she ever got married at all. And her mother has come at the age of 30, and so she only has a little two-year-old at home. So she's trying to find out how things were back when they were young.
Okay.
And of course, her mother is actually, her own mother is actually still alive. So she keeps talking to her and saying, don't worry about a thing. Everything will work out better later, which totally confuses this poor young woman who, as far as she knows, has a two-year-old at home. She's trying to have a conversation with this woman that she's on in this field with, and it's her daughter. So they have to be very clear with each other about their relationship with each other.
Right.
The most fun is, of course, the grandmother, who's only 20 at the time, in 1932. Yes. So she's absolutely a country Irish girl who's totally innocent in that not-so-innocent kind of way.
Right.
And she has no axe to grind. She has her own history, and we find it out.
Okay.
But she looks at everything from a very positive and happy point of view. So she's having a wonderful time doing that. So that's what this play is about.
How did you come up with it? How was it selected? Who picked it?
Well, actually, I think David Perry, who's the president,
yes,
saw this play in London, or possibly in New York. Hugh Leonard has written, I don't know, he's 90, I think.
Yeah.
And he's written, this is possibly one of his latest.
Right.
He wrote this one in 1999, so it's not very old. And I think they might have seen it in New York or in London. And of course, when it's, we're just running it to open in about a week. But he's the lightness of it. It's very light and fun and lovely part for three women. And so often there aren't very many parts for good parts for women
right.
in theater. And obviously they enjoyed the charm of this play because it's very charming.
And how have you found the experience of working on the play and bringing the characters to life?
Well, it has been extremely interesting for all of us because we've had to do a lot of research because we had to become quite comfortable with 1932, and she refers back to 1921.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to know who Griffith and Michael Collins were, and the how important the nuns were, and the ecumenical, and the bridge in Dublin where the ecumenical took place. So we have a huge range, and these are young actresses.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to be, and they are. So for young actresses, anything sort of post-1980, I mean, they're not even sure about the first war in Iraq, you know. So
and
it's been quite interesting for them.
And of course, putting that in context, it also means that the characters cannot relate to the time frame of each other either.
No, that's exactly it.
Either forwards or backwards.
No, it's absolutely the truth. When the young mother, who is in 1964, talks about the death of Kennedy, well, of course, the lady in 1932 has no idea what she's talking about
right.
and drifts off. And the young woman in 1999, 2003, it's ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
She's almost forgotten all about it.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing her PhD in ancient Greek history. So she goes from ancient Greek history to now.
Mm-hmm.
And all these references, none of them know what the other one is talking about. And, of course, they have no idea what's going on in 1999. So they can't really, and every once in a while in the play it's rather fun, because they actually say things about one of the parts of the play. The woman in 1932 says, "Where would I be without my wireless?"
Yes.
And the woman in 1964 says, "Where would I be without my telly?" And the woman in 2000 says, "Where would I be without my mobile?"
Right.
And they can't imagine what each of them is referring to.
Right.
So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun because you're watching people try and figure out. And there's the family relationship. There's the family relationship.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
daughters and the mothers and this other one's mother and that sort of thing. Plus the historical relationship. And I think that's something I don't know a lot about because, I mean, even here in Canada, we see how it's so difficult to talk from generation to generation. And this, of course, is classic.
Yes.
This is classic.
Yes. Yes.
This inability to talk through the generations. And so you end up having to, you know, you either get into it the way they do sometimes, they really do get into it, or you end up talking in sort of platitudes, unfortunately.
The cast, how did they embraced it instantly?
Absolutely. They really did. And
right.
you can see that they
yes.
have.
Yeah.
And I'm very lucky. They're very, very talented. And
so a production like this, Carol, you started out with your readings when?
We had our auditions in mid-March.
Yeah.
And then we had a read-through, and then we had rehearsals three times a week.
Yeah.
And because of the history of this play, we've had to spend dual time. When we're reading and rehearsing, we've had to spend a certain amount of time making sure we know what we're talking about. As a director, I insist that my actors know what they're talking about.
So if you were to talk about the number of hours...
The number of hours...
That each of these girls have had to
oh,
put in
right.
before opening night.
Oh, yes. They usually, we figure out that the number of hours of rehearsals is somewhere between 70 and 90. All right, so each of them has done 70 to 90 hours. Plus, of course, they've had to learn all their lines when they're not here.
On their own time.
And there's a fair amount of singing and that sort of thing, so
yeah.
they've actually had to go away and learn some music and some singing. Not a lot. It's not a musical, but they've had to go back and listen to John McCormick
yeah.
and Chopin and all sorts of ancient references to
yeah.
get their music.
So when the curtain goes up on opening night...
When the curtain goes up on opening night, they put in somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 100 hours.
Yeah. And what is
fascinating and what's fabulous is that this is voluntary.
Oh, yeah. They love it. We all love it.
And that's what is there. The people are there for the love of it.
Because, you know, creating something from what's in a book.
Yes.
And we, another thing that I really like to do with actors is it's a combined. I'm not the kind of director that says, no, it has to be this way.
Right.
We work on it together.
Yeah.
And so that by the time it comes to opening night, nobody's standing where they don't feel comfortable standing. Nobody is reacting the way they don't feel comfortable reacting. We all work it through. And we try to do it based on who we've decided the character is.
Okay.
How would the character do this?
Right.
So that, you know, it works very well. And it's a very, very enjoyable experience for all of us. Kay O'Hegarty is my assistant. And she, I mean, Kay is so busy in the Irish community.
I know.
And with the Irish Society. But she loves working with the theater. I think she got into that with her own children, that
right.
They're both in the theater.
Yeah.
And so Kay is my assistant, and a wonderful eye, and a wonderful one for the accents and historical references,
yes.
Because she is from Cork, I think.
That's right.
So Kay has been wonderful for that. And then I have Robin Ridduff has designed the set.
Okay.
And David McGladrey did the lighting, and Brad McKinley is doing the sound.
Okay.
And then I have Peggy Laverty, who is an absolute wonderful standby for Tara, because she has a treasure trove of costumes, and she takes care of costumes. And although it doesn't look like much, because it's three women out in the field, they have to look like their time, and they have to look good together.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's just the designers. And then we have the props people, and we have the stage manager, and we have the production manager, and the technical director. Oh, yeah, and all volunteer.
Yeah.
All volunteer.
So, Carol, a production like this is very, very demanding, and you have three, I won't say you have a lead, and you have three leads.
Yes,
literally.
We do.
Have you understudies?
No, we don't have any understudies. We're depending on these three women. And we keep them healthy as we can and make sure that we haven't worked them too hard. In spite of the number of hours that I mentioned, we're still only rehearsing three or possibly four times a week.
So when opening night happens, between opening night and closing night, the show must go on.
The show must go on, and they will turn up unless something dreadful happens. And that's happened in community theater. It has happened. And what happens in a situation like that, when it has happened, is that somebody that is available or willing comes and reads, and then they learn the lines like mad, and they're ready in 2 days.
Mm.
But it hasn't happened very often. And it's usually when someone's in hospital.
Right. So, the logistics.
Opening night is the 24th of May.
At the Arts Court.
Right, and we move in the morning of the 22nd, because it's right after the long weekend.
Okay.
So we move in the morning of the 22nd, and we'll be setting up the set, hanging the lights, focusing the lights, making sure the sound works, making sure all the cues work, and that sort of thing. Then on Tuesday night, we'll have what we call a cue to cue, which is making sure that we're connected with all the light and the sound cues. And then on Wednesday, we'll have dress rehearsal, and on Thursday, we open.
And you run Thursday, Friday?
Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and a Sunday matinee. So we open on the 24th.
Yeah.
And so we go 24, 25, 26 in the evening. And the 27th is a matinee at 2 o'clock.
Right.
And then we're free for a couple of days. And we run again. We have Cultus has
The 31st, I
think. The 31st. And then we're... Is it the 31st or the 30th? I think they might be...
Check the calendar on the Gaelic Hour. You click on the calendar, go on the website, it's there. I have it listed on the calendar.
Kay will know.
And so then you run that.
Then we
right
run the next
that
week.
Weekend
yeah,
as well.
The Thursday, Friday, Saturday of the next week.
And do you have a matinee? Do you finish?
No, we don't have a matinee.
So only one
matinee. We finish on the 2nd of June.
And tickets are available?
Tickets are available from the Arts Court box office. The number is on our website at taraplayers.ncf.ca.
Right.
And all the information is there. I don't have the number off the top of my head.
Okay, and again, there's a link on my website across to that.
Yeah, and of course, they're available. You can either phone up and order them with Visa, or you can come right down here and buy them. And of course, they're also available at the door.
Excellent. Carol, we're going to have a chat with one or two of the leading.
Yeah, the leading
lights,
actresses.
The leading lights.
Yeah, that'd be great. Very nice talking to you.
Adrian Blair, you played the character of the modern female. I do.
Of the three ladies in this production.
Yes.
How have you been enjoying rehearsal so far?
It's actually been very interesting to be in a cast with just three women. The previous play that I did for Tara was, again, a small cast, but much more of an ensemble cast. It was three guys and three women, and that was great fun to do. This is very labor-intensive for learning lines because there's really not a lot of time when we're not all three of us on the stage, and you're always engaged in what's going on. The idea being that I've brought my mother and my grandmother back to have a chat with them, and so I have to be interested in what's going on with both of them at all times.
So it's very much being in a time warp.
Absolutely, yeah.
How's the experience of being in the time warp?
Oh, well, being the eldest cast member as well, by not a good ways, but a certain amount of ways. Mara and Laura are both at least 10 years younger than I am, and so here I am, I'm again playing chronologically the eldest, but in a time warp, talking to my mother and my grandmother. So yeah, every once in a while you just have to give your head a shake and get your bearings again. But it's been really interesting.
From a playing point of view, it's certainly the writer, Hugh Leonard, has got in there and produced something or created something fascinating.
Absolutely. It's a real testament to the quality of his writing that you get it, as soon as you do. I really do think that quite early on in Act One, we've got the relationships established.
Right.
Once you've wrapped your head around that, there's plenty of generational conflict yet to deal with, but I really think he's done it beautifully, and especially for three women, and you know, with the mother, daughter, and grandmother dynamic, which is an amazingly complex dynamic, and he's really done it in a beautiful fashion.
So if it's taken you 2 years to come back to Tara this time, do you think you're going to wait another 2 years after this before you audition?
We'll have to see. I had been stalking the website for a while to see what plays were coming up and whether there was anything that I might suitably audition for, because not everything, you know, you're not going to fit absolutely every bill. But when I saw this, I was really intrigued. And I ran into Carol one day before the auditions even happened, and I said, "Carol, I've been thinking of you." And she said, "Adrian, I've been thinking of you. I'm doing a play." I said, "I know you're doing a play." She said, "I'd like you to come read." I said, "I was just going to ask you if I could." So, yeah, it was, fortuitous.
Good.
And, from the audition period on, it's been very interesting. It's been a fun ride.
Adrian, thanks a million for taking the time.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Mara Shields, welcome to the Gaelic Hour. Cara McKay was telling me that you, as you're the young member in the cast, and you play a grandmother, but you're a 20-year-old grandmother. How did you find that, and how did you find the part?
It does get a little confusing sometimes when the characters sometimes switch from the personality that they are presently in their time, and then the personality that the character who's in her own time, Katie, would know them as. So sometimes I'm a 20-year-old, and sometimes, as Carol says, use my granny voice, and I have to act more like the grandmother that Katie's remembering.
How do you find the transition?
It's all right, because she just she gave me some good advice. Just use your belly voice, and most of the time.
I mean, more mentally,
The lines are in kind of a granny tone, so it's kind of easy to skip with the line.
Okay.
She's being stern, so you just make your voice low and stern, I think. It's a good character. It's easy. I think it's all right to switch.
So prior to coming to Tara, where have you performed previously?
The only thing I did outside of my high school has been the importance of being earnest with New Edinburgh Players.
Yeah.
And then I did some high school plays.
Right. So this is your step onto the, let's not say the big stage, but the medium stage?
Yeah. It's the first play I've done that's kind of less of a comedy and more serious.
Right. So you're excited with opening night when it gets around?
Yeah.
What would you say was the most challenging thing you've found about the character and the play so far?
Probably the fact that I have to sing.
Okay.
And there's a couple parts that Kat, the character, has been into music her whole life and went to school music and teaches piano with her friend. And there's all these things I'm supposed to sing, and I'm not that good of a singer.
Right.
And the accent. So pretty much just the voice. But I think the character, it's a 20-year-old and I'm 19.
Yeah.
And they keep saying, "Oh, just be free-spirited, just be lighthearted." And it's not that challenging.
Good. Mara, I wish every success. I hope you have a fantastic run.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to sitting in the audience some night and enjoying the end product.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Laura Hall, you are the third cast member.
Yes.
In this wonderful play, and you play the part of Triana.
Yeah.
Triana is in the middle, in every respect.
Yeah.
But mother and daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And you in the play are what age?
In the play, I'm 30.
And you're in the 1960s?
Yes, 64 is the year I'm supposed to be.
So you're a 30-year-old in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Dealing with your 20-year-old mother.
Sorry. I'm getting mixed up now, too. Yeah, I'm thinking, wait a minute, no, my daughter's 37. No,
yeah,
the mother's 20, the daughter's 37.
Yeah, but your 20-year-old mother.
My 20, yeah.
And your 37-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. That must have been a mind-wrenching experience, just to keep your head around that. This is my mother, and this is my daughter.
Yeah, it's definitely a really interesting concept, and just, like you said, to wrap your head around it, I mean, just reading the script and then trying to act in that. I think it actually really helps for my character because I'm supposed to be really confused and disjointed and slightly angry. So I think it helps me bring that out a bit because it's true. You are confused and disjointed when you read it.
Right.
So
before this production, you have been on the boards around the city a number of times previously.
Yeah.
What other productions have you been in?
Well, I started out in Sock and Buskin Theatre Company, which is the Carlton Theatre Company.
Right.
Done a few shows there. I started with Hamlet, done about 4 shows there, and then I've done with Third Wall, Dangerous Liaison.
Okay.
Fringe, I've done a show on the Fringe called The Root of All Squares. And
So you're by no means a novice.
not really. I'm definitely still learning, but...
Yeah.
This
play itself, I'm sure you're looking forward to opening night.
Of course.
After all this work.
Yeah. I think we'll see a lot come out that we're still dealing with a little bit in the rehearsal process. But when it goes up on stage, I think a lot of things will come out when there's an audience in front of us, I think the energy will be up and the stakes will be higher.
I would imagine the emotion on opening night is different than the emotion on any other night.
Definitely. Definitely. Opening night, I think you're worried about everything. You think about everything. You think, am I going to miss my lines? Is my costume okay? Have I missing anything? And after that, you kind of let it go a little bit. And then it seems to kind of pick up. And then closing night, you're remembering everything again and thinking, my lines, do I know this, am I okay?
Right. What would you say has been the, within the production itself, within the character that you're playing, what, aside from the, that you're in the middle between your mother and your daughter, what would you say was the most challenging? And in watching you rehearse, first thing I noticed was you all have a huge amount of lines.
Yeah, the lines are somewhat difficult, but I think the most difficult thing for me is that Carol has cast us older than we are in real life. So I think that's been the most difficult for me, is relating to somebody who's older than me and is married and has a child.
Right.
That's definitely been a challenge because I don't have that, so I don't, you know, I've had to dig a little bit and try to relate.
In your character, you're what age?
I'm 30. And
You have a young child at that stage, yes. Because you have to stop and think again.
Yeah.
The other two girls, Adrian and Mara, the interaction there, the chemistry came together fairly quickly?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably the reason we were cast, as we were. We read with a lot of different people in a lot of different combinations, and the three of us just clicked right away, and it's been really fun.
Yeah, you can see it. Laura, I'm not going to keep you any longer, and thanks a million for taking a few minutes out of your rehearsal, and I wish you have a fantastic opening night.
Great.
And the nights thereafter are as much fun right up to closing night.
Yeah, I hope so too.
And I look forward to sitting down in the audience one night and getting to watch it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Camerton, and we will be back with you after these messages.
Chin Radio is proud Chin is proud to be serving over 37 different ethnic communities and representing over 20 different languages. Chin is proud to be Ottawa's only multicultural voice. This is Chin Radio, 97.9 FM, and broadcasting at chinradio.com.
The Adelaide is a distinctive one- and two-bedroom rental apartment complex located at Preston Square. The Adelaide is exactly where you want to be, close to downtown, easy access to the Queensway, and just a short journey to the airport. A short walk from Dow's Lake and the experimental farm, you can experience rural living in the heart of the city. The Adelaide is a smart building incorporating state-of-the-art security and environmental systems. Call for an appointment, weekday, nighttime, and weekend viewings. 613-230-1500.
The little Irish village in the heart of the Byward Market had its humble beginnings in 1992 with the now famous Heart and Crown. A second venue, the Snug Pub, since 1997. And then there's Mother McGinty's and Roisin Dubh, Black Rose. Since 2001, they complete the Irish village, each a treasure in its own way. Visit the Irish village. We can accommodate groups of all sizes. Private seating areas, spacious patios, and party rooms. Tell us about your special event and we will take care of the rest. 613-562-0674.
Welcome back to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Camerton, and we're going to continue our program now. But don't forget, the Corktown Bridge, if you want to sign that petition, it is still available online, and a good idea would be to get out there and do so. And the link for the petition is corktwnb.com/petition.html. And if you do a search on the internet and just put in Corktown Bridge, it'll bring up the place where you can go in and sign a petition before the meeting happens later in the week. So, yes, go on out there and add your signature if you haven't done so already to the petition. Before we talk to Anne Renault, however, we're going to listen to Belfast Andy and a piece of music called Gross Eel.
Winds were biting, so hook were back, lie the children of the gale. Embraced and turned forever, where the sea breeze softly wails. 3,000 miles from hell to here, another 20 still, to the fading view of the promised land from the graveyard on Gross Eel. To the memory of the thousands now, the sorrowful lives they gave, in search of their last great hope. Instead they found a grave. They fled their beloved native land, bid Erin's soil farewell. Crammed and moored the coffin ships, depths are mad at this set sail. Forced out against an angry swell by John Bull's floating face. Please remember this till the end of time, as England's damned disgrace. To the memory of the thousands, the sorrowful life they gave. it found a grave. Now the island is a monument to all God's children here, whose mass migration across the sea from the land they love so dear. Oh, it ended so far from their home, so far and yet so near, to their mortal salvation and to freedom's cry so clear. To the memory of thousands, sorrowful lives they gave in search of the last great hope. Instead, they found a grave. Bow our heads in silent prayer as soft tears from heaven fall, and the banshees croon sweeps around the cross where we gather one and all. In the hearts and the minds of the Irish clans, the sadness echoes still to the thousands who lie under Erin's turf and the graveyard on Blue Hill. This is the memories of the thousands, the sorrowful lives they gave in search of the last great hope. Instead, they found a grave.
I'm sitting in Library and Archives Canada with Anne Renault, and Anne has produced a beautiful book called Island of Hope and Sorrow, The Story of Gros Eel. And Anne is going to tell us about the book and what inspired her to write it. But first of all, I have to ask, who is Anne Renault?
Ooh, who is Anne Renault? Well, Anne Renault is, she's a children's writer. She's actually new to the field of children's writing. Island of Hope and Sorrow is my second book. People in Ottawa actually might be familiar with my first book, which was A Bloom of Friendship, the story of the Canadian Tulip Festival. That was published in 2004 and has been featured at the Tulip Festival both last year and again this year. And I say that I came late to the field of writing for children because essentially I've only been writing since, I would say, 1995. I first started in writing articles for children's magazines, and with the hope, of course, of becoming publishing a book for kids, and eventually I plugged away at it, and it happened.
What's your background? Where are you from?
My background is translation.
Okay.
I studied at Concordia University in Montreal,
right,
and French-English translation. Not that once I graduated, that's when I realized that I really didn't want to be a translator. And so I worked for McGill University for a number of years in AIDS research, conducting awareness, education and awareness programs, both in Montreal and across the province. And so my background actually has, very little to do, I think, in terms of with what I'm doing now. But I have to say that writing for children is a hobby. I do have two part-time jobs that pay the rent.
Island of Hope and Sorrow, the story of Gros Eel, is very much, a major portion of it is an Irish story.
It is.
What is the connection there?
Well, the way I select the topics of my books, they have to meet four criteria. They have to be of cultural and historical significance. They have to actually fill a niche. Again, like the book on my book on the Tulip Festival, there are no books for children on Gros Eel. There were no books for children on the Tulip Festival. So essentially, there has to be, I feel that I have to fill a need. I have to feel extremely passionate about the subject because it essentially lives with me for a year during the course of the research. And it has to also serve to a certain extent as a vehicle to preserve voices that would otherwise be lost.
Right.
And so in Island of Hope and Sorrow, we do have the story of Elsie Lake, who came over in 1922 as a home child.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to incorporate what I consider voices, or what I call voices, that would otherwise be lost, stories that haven't yet been committed to paper.
So when you said that this is a children's book, and mm-hmm. as a children's writer, how do you hope to reach children with something like this?
My target, yes, is children, actually specifically from 9 to 12-year-olds, so we're talking grades 3 to 5. And the idea is that the books that I write will be used in classrooms by teachers.
Okay.
And so the purchasers of the book, in addition to parents, of course, going to... librarians and teachers.
Okay, so you would be hopeful that this might end up in a classroom as something that a teacher would use to share the history.
Yes. To introduce children to immigration.
Right.
Because Fossil is very much an immigrant story.
Okay.
And so in broaching the topic of immigration, the same way that A Bloom of Friendship is being used in classes to talk about World War II.
So then the interesting question with something like this always then is, how do you get the word out?
We as authors have to do a lot of the legwork.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of knocking on doors, libraries, getting reviews. Reviews are very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So reviews in, for example, Canadian Teacher Magazine, that type of publication. There is a mailing that will be going out to all of the libraries and schools in the province, close to the launch date, which is actually in a few weeks. And and also what helped enormously with my first book is that it was nominated for 3 prizes.
Okay.
And so the Silver Birch, which is an Ontario-based, Hackmatack, which is in the Maritimes, and Red Cedar, which is in BC. And basically, those programs are in the schools,
okay.
encouraging kids to read.
Right.
So you really have to touch a lot of bases in terms of trying to get the word out and making people aware of the book. And, of course, interviews like this and
mm-hmm.
librarians and teachers that are listening in.
So the book itself, let's open the book. And the first thing that greets us is a beautiful piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we need to talk about is the book is beautifully illustrated throughout.
Thank you.
The art itself, where did it come from, the various pieces of art?
The way the book is laid out, there is a bit of everything. There are images of artifacts, there are photographs, there are what we call spot illustrations that were made by Iris Chung. He is the illustrator
mm-hmm.
For the book, and he does beautiful work. I've never met Iris. Usually the way it works for in kids publishing is that the publisher identifies the illustrator.
Okay.
I have no word to... I don't have any... input, so to say, in terms of the selection. They will run the images by me and ask me what I think, and I was very, very pleased with their
mm-hmm,
choice.
Mm-hmm.
You will also find images that were provided, an enormous amount of images, actually, that were provided the people at Grosil, that had a lot of photographic material. There were some images that were provided by the archives here
mm-hmm.
in Ottawa. There are images of the Jeannie Johnston, for anyone who's familiar with the Jeannie Johnston project. The Jeannie was rebuilt in Ireland and sailed to North America in 2003, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate enough to be a sail trainee on the Jeannie for the Montreal to Grosil leg of her journey.
So picking up the story of, as in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I notice you go back and you have history notes on each page also, which
yes.
are little vignettes, and you start your history notes with the Napoleonic Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time you refer to the lumber trade between Canada and Europe.
Yes.
So it's setting the scene.
Yes, I try to put it in context to go back, because essentially the story of Grosil goes back a little farther than the year it opened,
mm-hmm.
the reason why it opened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I give information explaining why, what the need was to have a quarantine station off of the mainland, and all the way up to today, what Grosil is today, which is a historic site that can be visited by the general public.
And, of course, the... story of Grosseal is it's a multicultural story. It's not just it's predominant. There's a lot of Irish, mm-hmm. and probably predominantly Irish. It's a multicultural story, and it is a very sad story in lots of ways, but a story of hope mm-hmm. in lots of other ways.
Yes.
Because you do describe the people who came through and survived but later died, and also the people who died on the island.
Right.
In researching this, what would you say was the... what did you come away from your research with?
I think the greatest gift that researching this book gave me was finding out through speaking... During the course of my research, I was speaking with distant relatives to find out where my own grandparents had come through. I knew that my grandmother is English from England. My grandfather was Irish from Limerick. And so I thought that perhaps there would be a possibility of one of them having come through mm-hmm. On a ship that would have stopped at Grosseal. And in fact, yes, I did find out that my grandmother, when she was 1 year old, her family came over on the Corsican in 1907, and that the ship did in fact make a stop. I don't think there was no indication that she would have actually set foot on Grosseal, but the ship that she was sailing on did. They did make a stop. They did let a family off that had contracted measles, and before they continued on to Quebec City. So that to me was the greatest thrill, because I then had a tangible link to Grosseal.
Mm-hmm.
And the story I thought was very compelling and fascinating. I guess to a certain extent I write out of frustration, because I think that Canada has so many amazing stories that have great cultural and historical value, and that have not been recorded, and that are not, our children are not necessarily made aware of them.
One of the other features along the bottom of page 16, 17, and I see also on page 22, 23, is a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And that is most useful in that, again, you start with the Napoleonic Wars at the end of them in 1815, and then 1827, the outbreak of the cholera epidemic in India. And one would wonder how something like cholera in India can end up having an impact on an island in the St. Lawrence mm-hmm. River, the quarantine station in 1832 opening at Grosseal.
Yeah.
It is fascinating to see the link between one side of the world and the other, even back in the early 1800s.
I agree completely. Now that I'm researching other books, I do see how we're all interconnected somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one huge family, and it is a small world when you see it in that way.
So, as you mentioned, you are researching further at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
What are you working on at the moment?
I'm researching a book on Pier 21, which I'm hoping will be published in 2008, and very preliminary work on another very Canadian story, which has been forgotten, which is The Empress of Ireland, the ship who had a greater loss of passenger life than the Titanic, and yet we don't know, or at least we know very, very little about the Empress of Ireland.
How far are you into some of that work?
For the Empress, I'm amazed, because the Empress, her lifespan essentially was from 1906 to 1914, I thought it was very unlikely that I knew that I would not find anyone who actually sailed on her, but then the challenge was to find relatives, descendants of people who sailed upon her. And people are coming out of the woodwork.
Mm.
I am amazed at the information and how forthcoming people are with their stories and wanting essentially to preserve their ancestors' stories and providing copies of ship manifests and photographs and artifacts from the Empress herself.
And is this these works meant to be for children as well?
Always, yes.
Okay.
I know.
That's
quite dark.
No,
when you look at that. But I do write fiction, which is much, much lighter.
Right.
But the nonfiction, it's they're like I mentioned, the four criteria. I think these are all topics that have great cultural and historical value and need to be told to children.
I would say one of the comments I know my wife and I were chatting recently about, our interest and awareness of history has grown as we've got older. And in many ways, we weren't presented with history when we were young in a format that I'm looking at this now. I read this I was coming back last week on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And what was wonderful was that on a relatively short flight, I was able to go from page one to the end because it's a nice short book. But it gave me a tremendous picture in every respect because of the graphics and the illustrations and everything else. But it was a nice, brief, concise, easy read, which is not my recollection of history.
No, I do remember some very, very boring times in history class. And in terms of whether I were to write for adults, the amount of research that I put in is still the same. The only difference is the way I present the subject. And so, yes, in terms of, I know that not only children, but adults will get something out of the book because essentially the research that went in, it is the same. It's just that the terminology is a bit more simplistic, and I certainly don't go into as much detail. But the challenge, though, for writing for kids is, of course, presenting information that sometimes might be a bit abstract in terms of concept and how to convey that to them. And wanting them, once they've finished reading a book, to find out more, I think that is the ultimate goal and the sign that, yes, that I've succeeded once they've read one of my books.
Because it can be particularly difficult, as you said, not just abstract concepts, but to convey what are time periods where a lot happened and were quite influential on countries and on nations and on people's heritage, and to be able to convey that in a way that is precise enough to be and yet readable, simplistic, but yet carries the message.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to do it in 100 pages. It may not be as easy in Latin.
You're right.
It's not as easy necessarily to do it in 10 pages.
Yes, I have conversations with my editor, and I keep saying, yes, but it's all good. You don't understand. You can't remove that. It's all good. And it is. It can be sometimes very painful to have to edit and to pick and choose.
Yes.
What is the essential? Because clearly, once the completed work, yes, is 24 pages, but I can tell you that I submitted much more than 24 pages to my editor when in the draft form. But yes, that is another challenge of making sure that children's eyes don't glaze over because they are bored from reading, because you want to keep them engaged. You want them to turn the next page.
And yet you don't want them to turn the next page without reading.
No.
No, that it's a delicate balance.
Yes.
It is.
Yes. And that's why there's a lot of imagery and there's a lot of, yes, there are words, but there are a lot of pictures to go along with those words.
So, and the official launch is when? What date?
Is Thursday the 24th of May.
Okay.
In Montreal. And it is in the evening because the target is actually teachers and librarians.
Yeah.
So we're having it in the evening so that they can come. And hopefully that they'll come away with copies that they can then introduce to their readers and their students.
And then it goes on distribution?
It's on distribution now. It can be ordered through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I mean,
okay.
That is already all set up. It'll probably be making its way to Chapters and other bookstores by, I would say, early June.
Fantastic, fantastic. It's wonderful also then that you can get your book into that type of a distribution channel. Because for an awful lot of authors, that is a major challenge.
You're right, and I know that there are some authors that will self-publish, and I couldn't imagine having to do the distribution on my own.
But even just being able to get it on their shelves is a tremendous achievement.
Oh, but there's a lot of begging and
oh, I'm sure.
and soliciting and saying, oh, by the way, I'm available for reading, yes, and all of that. Because the reality is that is also part of an author's job in today's reality.
Yes.
You really have to be work in partnership with your publisher to get the word out.
Right, right. Anne, thank you very much indeed
thank you.
Taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
And I wish you every success with this, and look forward with your next works as they come on stream, being able to see them. And it certainly is a credit to you, this piece of art.
Oh, well, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Camerton. Mary will be back with you tomorrow night with another night of music. Do join her here at 10 p.m. And this program will be made available on the internet later in the week, as are all the magazine programs going back to September of 2005. And the website, of course, is www.thegaelichour.ca. And the music that was played tonight, that will also be up on the playlist. If you want to send me an email, my email address is austin@thegaelichour.ca. The music on tonight's program was Belfast Andy, who is a Montreal performer from the north of Ireland, and it was a piece called Gross Eel, and that is from his CD All That Glitters. And the piece in the background at the moment is another piece called Gross Eel, and it comes from A Kitty's Kitchen. And that was recorded down in Toronto. My continued gratitude to the Irish Village and also the Embassy of Ireland for their continued support of this program, without whose help it would not be possible to stay broadcasting. So until tomorrow night with Mary, and until I get back with you next Monday evening, have a wonderful week. Kulasov, Slangafall.